All right, well, we're excited. Joining us now, author of more than 25 books of fiction and nonfiction, contributor to some of the greatest periodicals that have ever been created, and a contributor to the Armchair Golf blog with our good friend Neil Sagabiel. Welcome into the golf shop, author John Coyne.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, did I oversell you just a little?
A little bit.
Nah, come on, man. I'm so excited about this. I love having writers on who have a diverse background and a catalog of great works. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. What I'm proud of is my golf books and being able to relive my history in fiction.
Well, and most recently, you have been putting out in almost as a serial kind of. I'm gonna have a very Dickensian of you. Put it out in a serial on the golf blog. A sort of a history of caddies. And the role of caddies, and that's what caught my attention. I was checking in on Neil Sagabiel, and I saw your pieces, and I said, oh my goodness, this is fascinating. Explain your fascination with caddies.
Well, because it was what I did as a kid. I mean, I lived across from a Middle Lothian country club in Illinois, just south of Chicago, and I started caddying following my two older brothers at around 10 or 11, and caddied until I think my last round was when I was 21 and heading into the Air Force basic training, and at the same club. And when I was 15, they made me caddy master, and it's been all downhill since then. I mean, I had 300 kids under me there were 300 kids and men, trying to run a caddy yard when you're so young like that is a life experience. So it was wonderful. So, and I got to caddy in tournaments. I got to caddy with great pros of the period. And what I'm a big fan of caddying because for most kids, it's a way for them to see another way of living and another life, and it helps them grow up with an understanding of what the world is like before they leave their teenage years. And now, of course, since my day, girls are caddying too, and you have new roles for new systems developed. And I think everybody feared that when golf carts come in, that would be the end of caddies. But the country clubs, I'm in the up in the metropolitan area of New York, and up in this area, there is great caddy scholarship funds, and throughout the this region and other regions in the country, supporting caddies, getting them out on the golf course, because they in turn turn into golfers, and not only golfers but members down the line. So it's a great investment for everybody.
Yeah, and John, you know, I grew up in Massachusetts, as did Mike, and we had the We Met Caddy Scholarship Fund up there in the Massachusetts area, and right. I was the same as you. I mean, my dad was a club professional. We had a caddy program. We had guys that loved to take caddies every morning on Saturday and Sunday morning, and if kids showed up to caddy, they were definitely going out and working. You don't see that as much down here in the Carolinas anymore. It's kind of a lost art. How do we get that back? How do we get caddies back in play more often and get these kids out learning more, not only about the games, but about life and about themselves?
Well, I think that the certainly has to be a country club effort. And I think that if they start programs, invest in the kids, the kids will pay off as they become adults. It was first started, of course, by Chick Evans and the Chick Evans Fund out of the Western Golf Association, which is a phenomenal thing that has scholarships for college to go to college programs throughout the country. And they've expanded their program. They're here in the New York area now. And if kids know that and their parents know that, they'll get them off the couch, get them away from their games, and send them out onto a golf course, and they'll learn a lot, and they'll spend their summers meeting people who will influence their lives beyond their own parents, successful men and women who play golf and who are not only invested in their country club, but also be invested in them as part of their country club as caddies. It is tough because it's I don't know whether it's more expensive in the long run than golf carts, but I see a trend towards it. As I understand it, the number of younger people coming into golf has started to increase again, and so many things today work against being a golfer, even because golf takes so long, everybody's afraid that they can't afford that much time away from their iPhones. But as society changes, I think more and more people will come back to golf. I mean, we've as a recreation and as a sport, and with it, caddy ranks will grow.
Yeah, I mean,
anytime I can, I try to promote them. Kids going up, becoming caddies, and it changed my life, and it'll change theirs.
Yeah, I mean, I remember lugging double bags around Belmont Country Club. Oh my goodness! Now, and I learned a lot in trying to do that, fueled only on a 6 ounce Coca-Cola and some Oreos.
That's right.
I think the big challenge might be begging clubs, private clubs, to take a longer view of this. Because right now they see rounds are down, memberships are down, and the cart fleet, which they've paid for or are leasing, is an immediate expense. And they see it as a threat. And I think I would love to see some clubs commit to being, maybe bring in a few caddies, see if they can get it going. And then maybe the next time their fleet is due to be renewed, they renew fewer carts,
Right.
But then they have events they have to host. And so what if now all of a sudden at events in the middle of the week, you don't have enough golf carts and there certainly aren't going to be kids there because they're in school? How do they make it work? I mean, I think this needs to be a long view movement, but I'm with you in terms of what people can learn, getting juniors into the game, getting them to understand it. I mean, we're talking about there's an online auction going on right now where the goal is to get junior rounds down to around $5. So if
I saw that.
Yes, yeah. Fantastic. So have people can do that. So
that's right. That's right. And then we'll get them back. The other thing, the other hidden secret about caddies, they'll speed the game up because just having them, grabbing the bag, doing the rigging the trap, finding the ball. I mean, it's all of that will help speed golf up, which is a detriment to the game now. It just takes too long to play around.
So you've done this caddy series, and how has the life of the caddy changed? I mean, now, like you say, when these guys, if they make their way all the way to the tour, it's a very different life than it used to be. How has caddying at that level changed the most that you've noticed both in your lifetime and in your research?
Well, when I, as a kid in the late 40s, early 50s, The caddy was an old guy that that went from place to place, sort of a one step above a hobo that would make a little money and then go out and spend it on booze. Then it began to become players could spend their whole life playing golf and not being a home pro. Then the television came in and raised the fee, and then of the tournaments of what person made, who could pay more for a caddy, and if a caddy could become a semi-professional. What I'm hearing now that the basic weekly salary of a caddy is anywhere from $1,500 to $2,500, plus 7 to 10% of the player's winnings, and if they're in the top 10, that. The caddies could get 10% of what the player would win. Anyway, as we know now, a player who wins a tournament's making $1 million. So that's happened. So it's possible to make a living as full time as a caddy. It's a short season for the most part. I mean, most 20 to 30 weeks a year, but they can also earn endorsements. That's a new thing that they've got organized into quasi union now. So they're getting sponsors who are paying them anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 for wearing their hats or having their name on their sleeve of their shirt. Also, you get the FedEx cut, which has brings in another $35 million in bonus structure, and caddies on that one, if they do well there, they can earn up to 10% of a share for a winning would be $1 million. So it's become possible to do it. There's still some problems with the PGA and that they have to work out, because these caddies now are college graduates who love the game, but they also have families back home, and they have expenses that go beyond just, you know, what it used to be, where someone was just taking care of themselves and traveling this by car or somewhere. Now they fly, they go, they're traveling around the world mostly. So it's some pros pay for part of this expense that the caddies have besides carrying their bags. But a caddy is important. A caddy is the key person. As we all know now, it's a lot different with pros have a psych coach, a putting coach, a driving coach. I mean, they have a whole team supporting them on the tour. But the guy on the fairway or the woman on the fairway with the pro is the only person that's talking to him, keeping the player focused and advising him, being a resource, if nothing else, just to listen to the player complain about something. And they're vital to the relationship, and that's why if the caddy does something wrong, like, for example, step on a ball or do something, that penalizes the pro player. They're a team. And now we're seeing more and more tournaments, people, spectators, everything recognizing that there is a team and the caddy is a personality just as their players are a personality.
Again, author John Coyne joining us here, done the series on the caddy who won the Masters, played with Hickory, and knew Ben Hogan. John, in your travels, what's some of the hidden gems that you found in terms of not only a vacation spot, but maybe being able to sneak out and play a couple rounds of golf?
For myself, you mean, playing?
What's some of the hidden gems you found out there?
I'll tell you what. My favorite place internationally to play is in Spain. There's a little country club in on the island of Menorca, which is in the Balearic Islands, which is next to Mallorca. It's a small island, 30 miles long, 30 miles wide. They have an 18-hole course, which is new, designed by a noted European designer. You can go there on vacation, enjoy the beaches and the history of the place, and walk out. And they have a set of golf clubs for you. If you want, you can have a cart. You can walk the course. It's not a particularly difficult course, but it's very tricky. It's not long. It's par 79. That's one gym that I really love. And of course, my favorite of all is any course in Ireland. If you get to play it, is an experience unto itself. Especially in Western Ireland, they're tough courses, but they play in all kinds of weather. And in Ireland, they get all kinds of weather. Those are two spots that I like a lot. I haven't played much in Africa. I did in South Africa. South Africa has a ton of good golf courses, and you can see why they have such great players, going back to Gary Player and Bobby Locke and everybody else. And Bobby Locke was the first pro I ever followed and watched back in 1949 when he was won the Victory Open, which was the last tournament then. And it was played at Midlothian Country Club. He set this course record, and he was a phenomenal player that sort of been overlooked by history, and won the British Open a number of times, as well as in a number of tournaments in the United States, like the Old Tam O'Shanter, which was in Niles, Illinois, and which started by George May and was the first big tournament to offer serious money to pros. They paid, when most tournaments the winner was making a couple of thousand, he offered $50,000 to the winner, and he had an All-American tournament and a World tournament, and it went on for well over 2 weeks, both pros and PGA pros, and also PGA women, little LPGA was there as well. So it was a phenomenal several weeks in August and back in the 40s or in early 50s. It was the first tournament that was actually telecast live and started the whole movement on television.
Well, John, we have just about a minute left, but I'd like to ask you for your number one travel tip when you land someplace domestically or internationally, whether it's looking for golf courses, restaurants, places to go. What's your number one recommendation for the first thing you should do to get those kind of tips? Because travel is really about your level of adventure.
Well, the first thing, I mean, I would say the first thing that I do is get settled. You know, you have your hotel. Traveling today is tough because of all the security, et cetera. But get settled in a hotel and find. Then, if you're going to the golf course, check it out. What's available, what's possible, and don't jump into something immediately. Take your time to relax and cool down, and don't try to play 18 holes like on the first day or so. You have to build in your jet lag wherever you go, and that's important for really enjoying a tournament or a trip, and also enjoying a vacation. So anticipate that you're going to experience jet lag. It usually comes on the second day that you're in country and you suddenly hits you. So that would be my first bit of advice.
Well, John, man, we appreciate you coming on. We didn't even get to your instructional series because I need to know how to write a novel in 100 days. So anyway, well, we're going to get you back on. Yeah, we're going to get you back on.
All right. Thanks very much. Great talking to you, Mark and Mike. And it's been a pleasure.